I wanted to project myself into their life in Philadelphia. I wanted the eclectic group of friends who came in and out at random. I wanted the adorable baby. I even wanted the struggles. I don't know. I guess I didn't dream big, but I just wanted to argue with my hot husband over, you know, playing squash with his friend when he said he'd be home for dinner. So yeah, living that life was my fairy tale.
Hello world, it's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the big wheel generation who know the perfect technique for twirling themselves into a phone cord without getting tangled.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we're saving the Tuesday night TV show that centered around a close-knit group of angsty friends in Philadelphia who were all a decade or more older than us, but whose lives we related to anyway. We may have only been 20-something, but we couldn't get enough of 30-something.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists. Do you remember the first time you felt like television was talking to you instead of at you? Well, for a lot of us, that moment came in late 1987 when a little show called 30-something slipped into our living rooms. Or in my case, my dorm room. The show wasn't glamorous. It wasn't glossy. There were no shoulder pads the size of bread loaves or catfights by the pool or scary situations in the ER. Instead, there was a group of 30-something-year-old friends who were just trying to figure out how to adult, worrying about babies and friendships and lovers and whether their marriages were even going to survive. And for many of us Gen Xers, it didn't matter that we were years away from being 30-something. Watching Michael and Hope, Nancy and Elliot, Melissa and Gary and Ellen felt like watching older siblings just a few steps ahead of us, stumbling through the same messy and real questions we were starting to ask. And today we're finally pulling up a chair to that kitchen table in Michael and Hope's forever under construction kitchen with exposed drywall, grabbing a bottle of beer from their fridge, and remembering why 30-something mattered so much to us and to much of our generation at a time when we were all just learning how to be grown-ups ourselves. If you remember, 30-something aired on Tuesday nights on ABC from 1987 to 1991, and the three of us were huge, enormous fans, despite the fact that we were all a full decade plus younger than 30-something. I mean, I was only 18 when it began, yet we were obsessed. And this show impacted each of us tremendously in what I suspect are very different ways.
100%. So as the oldest of the three of us, I was actually 22 years old when 30-something first aired. And this show, you guys, it became my handbook for how to adult, truly, because I had graduated in May of that year, so May of 1987. So I've got my first real big girl job. I'm playing that whole yuppie stereotype. And thinking, I'd been dating Andy for a little over 2 years, so I knew that we'd be getting married one day. You know, that was just set in stone in my head. So 30-something was like my blueprint. This is who Andy and I were going to be. Andy was in advertising.
Oh, my God.
I know.
What?
I know.
That takes it to a whole different level.
Yes, it does. Whole different. And I, you know, had lived in the East Coast, so I could kind of picture that whole Philadelphia scene and having a cute little, like, you know, fixer-upper house because Andy's really handy. So all of that just kind of fed into this narrative that I was just going to play out. I was just, like you said, a few steps behind, but I was going to follow their instructions step by step into this next big chapter of my life. And that's how that show went for me, its entirety.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
It's and I think it will differ quite a lot, depending on how old you were, even by a year or two or three.
Yes.
Because if you were 18, it might mean something to you. If you were 15, it might not mean anything to you at all. So I'm really interested to hear what our listeners think about this and who it affected and who it didn't. Were you a teenager? Mm-hmm. Were you an almost adult? Were you a child? Because Gen X covers a lot of territory. So I'm very, very curious. It's hard for me to even talk coherently about what I've experienced in the last week rewatching these episodes. I think I've been more Manalode this week than at any other time in PCPS history, especially with two episodes in particular that I'll talk about in a little bit. But when I talk about the show now, I'm always so confused about why I/we were so into it. And truthfully, until the three of us started talking about it, I didn't even know if other people my age watched it because I knew it wasn't for us. I thought I was very aware that these people were not my generation. And if you think about it, they were only 10 years younger than our parents. And I know it's weird. And I remember recommending very enthusiastically because I loved it so much. So I was 19 years old in September of 1987 when I started watching it in my dorm room, like Michelle, surrounded by all of the women on my floor.
Oh, yeah.
And the next year, so season two, I had a class on Tuesday nights with my friend Lynn.
Oh, my heart.
And it was from 6 until 8:55 p.m. We were taking Judaism with Rabbi Melamed. It was a 3-hour class. And we would sit there at 8:50. We were already had our jackets on. We had our bags on our shoulder. And we're just praying, literally praying for Rabbi Melamed to stop talking. And we're watching
the
clock.
Well, at least you were in the right class to have your prayers answered, maybe.
And then we would, as soon as she let us go, we would run. And when I say run, I mean literally. We would run across campus to Iterbo Hall next door. We would go to the cafe in the basement called The Pause. We would order nachos on a paper plate. We would order one big cup of half Sprite, half water for my friend Lee. We would run up the stairs to my friend Lee's dorm room. And the goal was to get there before the music started.
Oh, you don't want to miss that theme song?
No, you can't miss the pan flute. Oh, you can't miss the pan flute.
The opening credits.
The opening with the she's on top of Michael and the baby.
With the baby crawling by.
And she kisses his cheek. And
yes, and we would just be like sweating, just sweating.
I'm sweating listening to you tell the story.
Yes, it was important. Oh, and then my senior year, we oftentimes watched the show Next Door, where the guys lived, including Mike, who would someday be my husband.
Yeah.
It was the equivalent of what you just talked about, Michelle, of grabbing a beer out of out of Hope and Michael's fridge without asking, which, by the way, was Michelob Dry. And we started drinking Michelob Dry because they were drinking Michelob Dry. We would just walk into their house and turn on their TV. And now I know that we were trying to make them be our Michaels and our Elliots and our Garys because they weren't having it. They just walked around us totally uninterested, like we weren't even there. But we were trying to claim them as our Michaels and our Garys and our Elliots.
Right.
It was confusing for me because, you know, that I was so wrapped up in this show. Even at the time, it was confusing for me because I was very aware that I had no big dreams of getting married and having babies like Hope and Michael. That was not my fantasy. I was not that interested in grown-up things of completing the picture-perfect grown-up life with the house and the picket fence and the 2.4 kids. And I was really quite scared to death of Hope's life being, you know, she was married, no job, consumed by baby care. I mean, Hope was not that into it either, to be honest. I actively did not want that. So why was I hooked so hard? But now, after watching the show for a few nights, the secret has been revealed. I get it. I totally understand. Hope and Michael were the nucleus of this show, but they were surrounded by this group of friends who were, in my mind, their college friends. That's what I put upon them. I was projecting. And those were the people who circulated in their orbit. And this was a carbon copy of my current situation, where you've separated from your family of origin and now your friends are your family.
Yes.
And I was watching how this friend family could be brought with you into your future. And that was my fantasy. These people are going to be my family forever. It doesn't have to end here. And we all have different crises to be managed, just like we do now. Not now. I mean, then. Just like we did then. It was mostly love, work, and sex. Love, work, and sex. Love, work, and sex. And there's no denying how important the role that sex played in drawing us into this show, because they talked very openly about sex, not in lewd ways.
No.
Or scandalous ways, except for
having
stupid
it,
Elliot.
Not having it, basically.
Having
right?
it or not
craving
having it.
Craving it,
yeah.
Wanting it, yes. not wanting it.
Realistic. Not working.
Which, yeah, right. we'll get
very,
into.
Very,
yeah.
very realistic. And they were talking about it in the way that friends do. And it portrayed sex not as a fantasy romance, not soap opera sex, but in a very lighthearted way and a realistic way.
Yeah.
How it gets interrupted when the yeah. baby cries or when your mom knocks on the door. And it the whole thing just validated our experience as new adults. Like, we belong here in this place and this sexual place, and it's not dirty or wrong. It's nice and it's complicated. And this was the real fantasy. It wasn't Donna Reed has been house baby. It was being loved yep. and supported and listened to by an adorable partner in very tender ways while maintaining a friend-focused life with the people you grew up with. It was like St. Elmo's Fire Part 2.
Yeah, it kind of was. Mm-hmm. That's a great analogy. I like mm-hmm. that.
You guys, yeah. I want to weep right now. I feel like, you know, we're in our fifth year. And I don't know if there's been a discussion in 240-something discussions that I have felt closer to the two of you.
I know.
Than us having this conversation about 30-something. It's like I want to say to you guys, I found my people. I know. I found my people, like, with you guys 7 years ago or whatever, mm-hmm. 6 years ago. But, like, to know how much this meant to me, and then to hear you guys reflecting it back to me, I want to reach through my screen and physically kiss each of you. I love you so much. And I love
it's like
also that
I... 30-something come to life. It's 30-something right. happening right
said,
now.
This is the most excited I feel like I've ever been for a conversation, because we still have more to come, and I don't even yeah. know how I'm going to handle it. But I just said earlier, you guys, that we were all obsessed with this. In what I suspected were very different ways, but listening to the two of you right now, again, I feel so bubbly inside because it's not that different, even though I'm, you know, a little bit younger than you, because obsessed is too small a word to describe my relationship with 30-something. I was consumed by this show, and Hope and Michael in particular. I was just starting college, like I said, in the fall of 1987, and I latched onto this show so hard, my roommate and I did together. People often say that the characters and the stories in 30-something are so relatable. That's what made it so successful. But for me, from age 18 to 22, think about it, they were not. But for emerging adult Michelle, 30-something was a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. A fucked up fairy tale, for sure. But it was a depiction of young adult life that looked amazing to me in its normalcy, which is exactly how that relatability then played for me.
That's what you wanted.
Yeah. So cut to mm-hmm. season two, and little emerging adult Michelle has her first serious boyfriend. And to me, we looked more than a little bit like Hope and Michael. You guys, I would cut out every 30-something picture from magazines and pin to my bulletin board next to pictures of me and Brian. Because, oh, spoiler alert, everyone, I married my Michael. Doesn't have hair anymore, but that's fine. Yeah. And I'm not wrong. We totally could have been the 19 and 20-year-old versions of Hope and Michael. I actually still have all the things that I had on my college bulletin board my junior year in a box. And I'm going to post in this week's Weekly Reader, because I want to see what you guys think. If you could be like, oh, that could have been them at age 19 and 20. We'll see. But like I said, 30-something was the illusion of the life I wanted and aspired, even with all the constant messy parts. Fucked yeah. up fairy tale, like I said, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what 19-year-old yearns for an old fixer-upper with leaky pipes and exposed drywall and an overworked husband and a crying baby instead of like a cool loft in Soho where you get to get dressed up in fancy clothes and go out to the bars every weekend looking for guys, right? I did. Me, Michelle. Yeah. I did.
Yep.
And I got that it was a depiction of real life. And really, that's all I wanted. I wanted yeah. to project myself into their life in Philadelphia. I wanted the eclectic group of friends who came in and out at random. I wanted the adorable baby. I even wanted the struggles. I don't know. I guess I didn't dream big, but I just wanted to argue with my hot husband over, you know, playing squash with his friend when he said he'd be home for dinner. So yeah, living that life – was my fairy tale.
And it makes so much sense, Michelle, because you wanted something normal and predictable and reliable and constant, mm-hmm. something that yeah. you had to navigate so much when you were a kid. And you're like, I don't want to navigate anymore.
You know what? That's a really good point. I lived mm-hmm. a really chaotic and unpredictable childhood, certainly until I was in college. And so, mm-hmm. it's, I used to say to my therapist, I get how funny it is, ha ha, that Michelle's first serious boyfriend, she married him. You know, this is going to work. This is going to be it then for the rest of it. But yeah, that's what 30 something represented to me, even though it was messy.
But messy in a very normal way.
Yes. And you can look at even the messiness of like Nancy and Elliot. But yeah. you know what? Even that they were working through for sometimes. Yes. Sometimes they yeah. weren't. You know, season one, yeah. not as much. But they were working. They were gonna try to keep providing that constant, you know, that stability. Right. So I've decided though after rewatching, we two have been rewatching Brian and also by season two, Brian watched all these with me because believe me, that's what I was watching on Tuesday night, and I was usually at like his mm-hmm. frat house room or whatever. So I was like 30 something's on. I've decided I'm going to get him some suspenders for Christmas.
Of course you are.
Maybe a pair of pleated pants. Real pleated.
Yes. Let's just bring
Michael
back
wore
that
some
thing.
Pleated pants.
He did.
They got bigger as time went on.
They
yeah,
did.
Bigger
like,
and
where
baggier.
There's like almost puffiness kind of down yeah. in that pleated that was, part or whatever.
Yes.
Very 90s. Mm-hmm.
They're all so pleated and puffy. And then all of Hope and like Ellen's and Melissa especially, they're the giant.
Everything was just giant.
Covering their cute little bodies.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and you know, Mike always says that the late 80s were really hard for boys who wanted to see girls because we were always wearing these giant sweatshirts.
Yes,
and they're like, I don't know what's under there.
I have no idea.
Well, and you add the shoulder pad, which, you know, like when we talk about our shoulder pads, we always all laugh, listeners, because we always think of the Carol Burnett sketch with the, you know, the curtain rod. But you really couldn't see anything because our shoulders went out about 8 inches longer than our actual shoulders. So then the shirts just hung.
Right. Straight. I remember when Maggie and Grace were like in high school and they'd want to get a sweatshirt and I'd be like, okay, large or extra large. And Grace would be like, I think it's between small and medium I should get. I'm like, nobody gets a small or medium sweatshirt. Like, they shouldn't even offer that as an option.
They went all the way past your butt. Your sweatshirt was there. With the band of the sweatshirt would go around your thighs.
Yes.
And I'm kind of loving that that's back.
Yes, with your stirrup pants.
I'm kind of loving that the big baggy sweatshirts that kind of go over your wrists and stuff are back. Like now I always get size large of everything.
Mm-hmm. Is it any wonder?
That also has to do with my body getting larger.
and I'm saying our generation, we're kind of bringing that back. We loved it then and we love it now. It kind of, mm-hmm. it's comfy. It, you know, leaves stuff to the imagination.
You know what? Also, I got reminded of some of the smallest details that you forget about an era that don't seem important, but you're like, hey, yeah, why don't we do that anymore? In this show, women are always sleeping in a t-shirt. Just a t-shirt. Yeah. I always slept in just a t-shirt. When did I start wearing pajamas?
Exactly.
I don't know, but I've gone back to the t-shirt because Andy's are nice and 100% cotton, and they are kind of big on me. I mean, they're not the cute ones that would come down to my knees, and I thought I was all that, like sleeping over in his dorm room or whatever. But they're really comfortable, and they're white, and they kind of absorb some stuff. And
Well, so anyway, I have nice pajamas. I have to get the cool, pajamas from like Selma. I have like eight pairs of those because they have to like wick my sweat away.
Yes.
Well, okay, we digress. So this show was so character driven and the storylines were so engrossing, but that's totally because of the strong characters. Michael and Hope, the newlyweds with a new baby, Elliot and Nancy with the two small kids and a rocky marriage. Y'all watching these back, have you just been watching little Ethan and going, oh man, that kid just pissed me off half the time?
He was such a
Ethan
shit.
Was just a little shit half the time.
From the get-go, from the pilot episode.
Let's just say, I mean, I think in like episode, like the first like you know, first like 6 or 8 episodes, he can be still kind of, he's just going with his plane. He's just always running that plane around.
In everyone's face.
You start getting into other episodes and he's, you're right, he's a little shit. And I, it was like I saw that kid's face yesterday when it came back up. I was like, ah, there's that Ethan.
And there he is. Remember if you had good friends that had a kid who was a little shit and you just didn't quite know how to handle like the friendship because you want to go, I don't want to go over there. That kid is out of control or whatever. But.
Well, and that was, and Nancy and Elliot were actually good teachers for me because even though I was not planning on having kids, I knew that I would someday. And I'm like, that's what I'm not doing.
Right, exactly.
I am not going with the Nancy and Elliot plan.
Yes,
this
is,
I'm like taking notes. This is not,
exactly.
It's good to know what your parenting style is. I'm like, I'm learning about my parenting style, not it.
Right.
Yeah. We were watching the other night and Brittany was in like under the table or something. And Brian's like, wait, who's she? And I was like, that's Brittany. It was like, I said it just like Nancy would. You know, that's Brittany. Yeah. So, don't you remember little Brittany? She was cute. Well, then we have Melissa, who was Michael's single cousin, who is an up and coming photographer with a lot of personality and a lot of style, let's say, and a lot of issues, who used to date Gary, Michael's best friend from college, who is a single professor for a hot second that we all, at least I did, swooned over. I thought Gary was super attractive, even though Michael was my, you know, Michael was my future husband. And then we have Ellen, quirky Ellen, Hope's lifelong bestie, who is still a single career woman and often feels like the seventh wheel, except for towards the middle to end of season one. I love when her and Melissa figure out that they are like, hey, we can be friends. Like, they start hanging out and it's just so, I just love their friendship. I think they're funny together.
It's very offbeat and it's very entertaining and you're so happy.
Yeah. Because they're so different. They're different. Well, I loved the whole friendship group so, so much. I loved the dysfunction and the arguments and the goofiness and the smart alecky comments and just the huge amount of love they so obviously had for each other. I mean, they could get into some bad arguments, like really bad, where they are yelling at each other, but they made up. And this is all making sense now, Kristen. Thank you.
Yes,
how much do I owe you for this therapy today?
Because I'm like, to me too.
I'll wait a minute.
You can argue and still and come out on the other side and be friend. Yeah, exactly.
And that it's good for your relationship to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I loved them all for different reasons. Like when the guys were all together, Kristen, this is like what you were saying.
That was sexy.
They cracked me up with their college level shenanigans still in their 30 something and their really stupid humor.
At that moment.
Yeah, because it was so real and it was very much what I was living in at that time with Brian and his friends were Michael and Gary and Elliot, you know, doing a stakeout. And then I also loved it when it would just be the girls hanging out because they're usually talking about the stupid things the guys were doing, which was also very real.
Right.
That's exactly what I was going through. And then when they're all together and they're typically in Michael and Hope's ramshackle fixer-upper, walking in the door without knocking, grabbing beers out of the fridge without asking. And despite this being such an ensemble, each character also had such tremendous individual character, if you will, and personality and struggles and triumphs, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sort of like Sex in the City where everybody, like, are you a Miranda?
Yeah.
Are you a Carrie?
I thought of the two.
Everybody chooses who they're going to be. And I think still a lot of the populace is veering toward Hope and Michael. Like they are the nucleus.
They are the nucleus. But I do think that, you know, what's super cool about the way this show was written, and I think we'll get into that in just a little bit, but they gave each of these characters such struggles and personality and storylines. If you go through just on like Wikipedia and just read the synopsis of every episode of every season, it's almost equally divided between these seven characters.
Yeah, and I think it feels like veering toward Hope and Michael because so much of the talking took place in their home.
Right.
Well, their mom and dad.
They were the mom and dad of the friend group. That's true.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And people could identify with a character in there. So, of course, like I said, I was identifying with Michael and Hope because that was my, you know, dream. But if you're the single friend or you're Kristen, you might identify with, you know, Ellen or I think everybody could find themselves in one of the characters, no matter where you were in your stage of life. And then all of those things you said, Michelle, the trials, the tribulations, the highs, the lows, you could relate to all, you know, to those as well.
So you could identify who you quote unquote were, but you could also identify who you aspired to be.
True.
That, that might be different. You may not actually be much like Hope, but you really want your future to look like Hope's. And so you're going to pin your hopes on hope. but the thing about Hope is that for the first time, somebody was telling the truth about motherhood. Hope was telling the truth about motherhood. This was not Donna Reed. She was not glorifying the husband and the house and the baby. She was showing how she was having difficulty with it and something had been taken away from it and all of the different the frustrations that came with it. And then Ellen offered the alternative to Hope. Mm-hmm. She's the childhood friend who works at City Hall, and she's got the big shoulder pads, and she has, you know, she's got relationships here and there, but she overtly says, I'm not really thinking about having children. I don't want that. She's the counterpoint. And then, like I said, Nancy and Elliot helped me identify my parenting style, which was not that. And then Melissa
it was like they had two kids. Sorry, but didn't it always seem like they had about 15 when you were like in a scene in their living room?
It was so chaotic.
Like, where the kids are just running back and forth and under the table and over the and like I said, Ethan's always got that damn like airplane that he's like over people's heads and dunking it in their coffee and then like climbing over them on their laps, and you're just like, somebody discipline this child.
And their parenting style was shrieking. That was their parenting style. I'm like, I'm not going to be a shrieker.
Yeah.
I mean, we could get into a whole discussion about this, about how they were unhappy with each other and their marriage and all this kind of stuff. But it all makes sense now as adults, right?
Yeah.
And now we've all been parents ourselves. So now we are like, have some boundaries, Nancy and Elliot.
Nancy and Elliot.
We've been parents, right?
Yes. Well, and Melissa was so important in that group because she was the personality. Everybody had a Melissa in their friend group. She was the one with the Doc Martens. And she would have, right? Everybody had one Doc Martin person in their friend group.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And ours was Wendy. Sorry, I just thought of Wendy. Yeah.
And there's one scene from one episode that was so immaterial and had nothing to do with nothing. And I've been thinking about it for 35 years because it was so funny and it was so Melissa. Melissa is at a big party, and for some reason she's stuck in a room with all the children watching TV. You know how they're like, throw all the kids in a room and turn on a movie?
Yeah.
And for some reason, Melissa's stuck with all the kids. And they're watching the Danny Kaye movie, Hans Christian Andersen. And little Britty keeps going, Hans Christian Andersen, Hans Christian Andersen. And she's saying, Amberson instead of Anderson. And Melissa just looks at her with such disdain, and she's like, it's Anderson. Like, she's arguing with this small child.
I can picture her perfectly. That might have been season one, the Thanksgiving episode, I feel like,
I think it was.
That's a great episode. But didn't you guys also feel like, with the love we all had of this show, you might have had a favorite character, but you sort of, you either aspired to be certain parts of a, I don't want to say names because I want to give mine away. Shocking. But like, you know, you aspired to have, you know, the fashion sense of this one, or the,
that's a good point.
You know, a personality trait of this one. Like, I can't say in this whole ensemble there was one that I disliked, but you liked little bits and pieces of them. You almost wanted to build the perfect person with little bits and pieces of each of them.
I did, at least. Usually in a TV show, they will set up, they'll set up an ensemble cast to have one person who's supposed to be either the villain or the anti-hero or the contrast. And yes, there's lots of contrast. You know, like I said, Ellen is the contrast to Hope. But you're not meant to dislike any of them.
No.
Every single one of them is somebody you felt something for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Except for Miles.
Except for Miles Drentel. Can I tell you how Husker Dude I got when I heard the name Miles Drentel? Miles Drentel is the evil owner of the advertising agency that Michael and Elliot work for, and he was vile. Miles Drentel.
Yeah, he was absolutely the villain.
He was the only villain. Mm-hmm. Besides Hope's parents, bless their hearts.
Well, parents, you know what? I could talk a lot about those the parent episodes, but I can't. We don't have that kind of time. No. Okay, but let's talk favorites. Did you have a favorite?
Let's see. Go ahead, Caroline. I was going to go ahead.
You know, I guess I would say hope, but it's in terms of that's the like person, like not specifically Hope herself, because honestly, sometimes I thought she kind of whined a little bit. But her life, I wanted her life. So yeah. In terms of yeah. aspiration, that was it. But early on, I would say I probably also aspired to Ellen's life, because I wasn't like right out of the gate thinking about having kids. So there was the aspiration of Hope, but more reality was probably being successful in my shoulder pads and, you know, whatever. What were my, never mind. My shoulder pads and my pantyhose and...
Yes.
The mm-hmm. cute, chic kind of, you know, yeah. short hair. She had was a businesswoman, right?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
she had business
the ultimate
hair.
Kind of mm-hmm. yuppie at that point, the young yes. urban professional. Yes. That's what I was yes. aiming yeah. for. So okay. In answer to that question, it was more their care, what those characters were doing, not necessarily the people themselves, if that yeah. makes any sense.
And that's
well,
kind of
like I just
saying.
Said. You yeah. liked, yeah, mm-hmm. you liked yes. a combination. You wanted a little yeah. bit of Hope and a little bit of Ellen. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was so very attached to Ellen, maybe because, like I said, she was intended to play off of Hope, who I was, I know, big shocker. This is going to shock Ooh. Nobody. And none of the things that we're saying are shocking any of our listeners. So I was actively trying not to be Hope. And Ellen's personality was like somebody, but I loved Hope. I have nothing against
sure,
I really,
no,
like if
I just
she would have been my
wife. Actively
well,
trying.
I, yes.
Yeah, but, I love how you just said, trying to not be her, but you loved her because look at Hope and Ellen. I love yes. how in episode one, they address right out of the gate.
Yep.
Right
they've
away.
Been not, they're not just college friends. They've been childhood friends. So yes. these two have been friends forever. And all of a sudden, and both career women, right?
Yep.
Both out of
mm-hmm.
college, career women. One gets married and has a baby. One doesn't. How do you now still be that good of friends when your lives are so right. wildly different, and you end up ultimately seeing that you still have this love of who you are inside for each other. And
yeah.
that's kind of what you just said. You, yes. you didn't want to be Hope, but you loved Hope.
I don't want
because
her life,
Ellen.
But I want to be friends with her.
yeah.
And there's a great scene in the pilot episode where Ellen and Hope are getting together for lunch and of course, Hope has to come in with the stroller and the baby, and then it's a very nice restaurant, and Ellen's trying to engage her in conversation, but the baby always needs something, and then the baby starts to cry, and Hope is just panicking, and she's trying to keep engaging with Ellen, but she's also unbuttoning her shirt and trying to get a boob out so she can make this child shut up. And then eventually, Ellen's like, you know what? You don't have to stay. You can go. And she's like, no, I want to stay. I want to stay. And Ellen's like, please go. This is torture. And so eventually she does pack up the baby and go. And they had to get through that moment. They had to talk about it. Like, what does this actually mean? But mm-hmm. Ellen's personality was like somebody I would have wanted to hang out with. She was funny without trying to be funny. She still really wants to have a good time. She's a little scared of Hope's life too, kind of like I was. And it's no accident that the two episodes that Manilowed me the hardest were centered around my two favorite characters. And that's when Ellen gets married and, I'm going to go there, when Gary dies. We spend 4 years watching mm-hmm. Ellen stumble and fall with her career trajectory and her love life. And she's on the brink of giving up when she falls for a truly good person. Everyone's like, she's going to do it. She's going to do it. But even then, her fear of abandonment might make her walk away from this beautiful situation. And so when she finally walks down that aisle, surrounded by all of her friends, on the arm of Michael because her dumb, deadbeat dad didn't show up, in a musical montage, no less, to Ray Charles's Come Rain or Come Shine, I am crying. I am crying like it's 1991. And I remember sitting on the couch and crying next to my friend, my roommate, Martha. And we're both crying at Ray Charles and Ellen and Michael in the musical montage. I was like in a different place. Mm-hmm. And I came to love this song, this Ray Charles song, Come Rain or Come Shine. I had never heard this song before. And now, to this day, it's still one of my favorite songs that will make me cry. But I have one question. How did I find out what this song was with no internet?
I have no idea. And I don't know how I got from point A to point B had Google Maps or whatever.
I call the reference librarian and say there was a song at the end of 30-something, but you can't see it because we can't stream it? I don't. So it's a mystery to be solved. I don't know how I found out what this song was.
The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. The three of us have loved shopping for gifts at Uncommon Goods for years because we always find the coolest one-of-a-kind gifts for everyone on our list. Some of our recent favorites? An old-school red Viewmaster that spins your own photos, a word search throw blanket with 15 of your own words woven right in, mixtape art where you customize the playlist, all perfect for your hard-to-shop-for partner, by the way. Oh, and don't even get us started on the many unique advent calendars that we know our adult children will love. But it doesn't matter who you're shopping for. Kids, teens, book lovers, history buffs, diehard sports fans, foodies, mixologists, bird watchers, gardeners, and yes, retro pop culture lovers, you'll find thousands of new and unique gift ideas you won't find anywhere else. And we love this. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/PCPS. That's uncommongoods.com/PCPS for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
But then how do I even talk about the episode where Gary dies?
I don't think we can.
This was a water cooler moment for the ages. It was like, who shot JR in reverse? Oh, because the answer is revealed to us first, like boom, like shot right between the eyes. And the surprise factor was magnified because of how beloved Gary was. They killed the golden retriever is what happened. Gary was our golden retriever.
Let's not forget, for how many episodes leading up to Gary's death had we all been thinking Nancy's going to die?
Nancy's going to die of ovarian cancer.
And all of a sudden in the episode where we find out that Nancy's not going to die, you guys, I was so gutted. I was so in disbelief. I was so pissed off.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I cried so hard. I couldn't sleep at night.
Yeah.
He wasn't just Gary to all of us who loved this show so much. He was actually, he wasn't Peter Horton playing Gary. He was Gary.
He was our Gary. He was our golden retriever puppy.
And the fact
puppy.
That he was biking to the hospital to give Nancy a book.
No, it's worse.
Wasn't it?
It's worse because he's driving, because Michael says, oh, this is going to break my heart. Okay, I'm going to set the whole thing up so we can get to the biking versus driving thing, because they're all at the hospital celebrating Nancy's surgery where she's now in remission. Everybody come to the hospital celebrating she's not going to die. And everyone's like, where's Gary? Where's Gary? So Michael goes out in the hallway on the payphone to call Gary. Doesn't answer. I'm going to call the machine at home. So he puts another quarter in the payphone, calls the machine at home. There's a message from a police officer saying, there's been an accident. Please call the police. And so he writes the number down on his hand, puts another quarter in the payphone, calls the police. That's where the world falls apart. Gary has been killed in an accident. And what happened was when he tells earlier in the day, when Michael and Gary are discussing going to visit Nancy in the hospital, Michael's like, Gary, do not ride that bike in the snow. The weather, it's so bad. Do not ride that bike. And Gary rides away on his bike and he's waving. So then when he goes to the morgue, he's biking away. So poor Michael has to go to the morgue to identify his friend's body. And he says, I told him not to ride the bike. I told him not to ride the bike. And the doctor says, oh, he wasn't riding his bike. He drove. And he was behind a tractor trailer truck that locked up on the icy bridge. It was an 8-car pileup. And Michael's face just goes and drops to the floor.
I want to bring the point about when you were saying you were watching it, Michelle, and you were just dumbstruck and you were with your roommate and just how could they do this? And I think about now, like, first of all, either you watched it that night or you didn't. It's like, it's not like you could watch it the next day. So there really wasn't such a thing as spoilers back then.
That's true.
There wasn't the way to like connect with other watchers or whatever. So there wasn't like any theories. I mean, maybe like it's going to be Nancy. If someone's going to die, it's going to be Nancy.
It was going to be Nancy.
For sure.
So that the shock factor back then, I don't know that you could replicate it now unless it was something real that happened in life, because somehow you would either get somebody leak something, or there's something, you know, something ahead of time, or certainly if you couldn't watch it that night for whatever reason, you're like, okay, I'm going to watch it tomorrow. You would have accidentally seen a spoiler, or you would have had to have actively avoided spoilers.
Yeah, people are talking about it. And even if you don't get the actual information, there are nuggets. There are enough nuggets that you know something is coming, right?
Yep.
And this is such good TV because it wasn't just us who was surprised.
Right.
So they told Gary, of course, because Gary's the one playing the role, but they did not tell the cast.
Right.
And so the cast is doing the same thing that we are. They're like thinking that Nancy's going to die. And they don't know until they sit down at the table read and they're literally reading the words out loud that they learn that Gary has died. And they said that moment where it starts to come out at the table read, they're going through the same thing we are when we watch it on TV. It's much like if you remember Radar coming into the OR, you heard about this on our MASH episode, Radar coming into the OR to share that Colonel Blake had been shot down over the Sea of Japan. They didn't tell the cast that Radar was going to come into the room and say that. And so the writers wanted to tap into that emotion of the actors. And they love Gary just like we do.
For the three of us, and for, I guess there's other people out there that liked the show as much as we did. Maybe, but no. But for all of you listening, I think, you know, the show was only on for 4 years. It was so impactful to us. But I don't know that you can talk to anybody who loved this show without Gary coming up, without that coming up with Gary.
Yes.
Because you can't not. And it's not that it overshadows all the other episodes, because there were so many other great things.
And that's what they did so well, and particularly in that episode, is the both and. Like, in one, you can be so happy and ecstatic that Nancy is okay and you're riding this high. And then in the same exact moment, you're riding the lowest of lows.
Yeah.
And that's kind of life. I feel like that's another thing the show did so well, was show us that it's not always, you know, whatever. It's not always roses and champagne, and it's also not always the bottom of the dregs or whatever. But it can be both, and they can be right on top of each other.
Totally on top of each other.
You, that roller coaster, and how do you reconcile that? That's just,
you know, so interestingly. The Edzwick and Marshall Herskovitz, who created 30-something and much of the storylines were based on their own life, they had this this like 2-year period in both of their lives where this, what you just said, Carolyn, the both and, I mean, their wives were having children, they were winning an Emmy, and then the very next day, one of them's father gets diagnosed with brain cancer. So now hearing you say that, I bet that's where this all came in. Like, we have to figure this out somehow, how we can illustrate this, that episode where Nancy, you know, where we find that and where Gary dies. And in 2009, TV Guide ranked Second Look, which was season 4, episode 76, aired on February 12th, 1991. They ranked it as number 34 on its list of the top 100 greatest TV episodes.
I'm so glad to hear that, because
and Patricia Wedig got an Emmy. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And also, I think Elliot should have gotten an Emmy too, because he has the job of telling his wife, who is celebrating that she's going to not die, that her friend has just died. And so he threads that needle so incredibly.
Yes.
So, I mean, I can't describe it for you. You just have to watch how he's like trying to tell her that her friend died, but he doesn't want to take away from her triumph. Anyway, oh my gosh.
It's horrible. Well, I just have to pop in real quick and tell you who my favorite was, because I'm sure you guys are on the edge of your seat.
Who could it be?
Well, I mean, it's probably a little obvious after just telling you that I basically modeled myself after her and aspired to be her and have her life. But yes, that was Hope Murdoch Stedman. And it's hard for me to separate her from Michael because, again, like I just said, I saw me and Brian as them. That's not creepy at all, though, right? And besides her great hair, oh my God, nobody could rock a ponytail. The ponytail was always perfect.
Yeah.
And her really cute baggy late 80s clothes. I just felt like Hope was really real. And yeah, she gets criticized for maybe being a little whiny or whatever, but so did I. I mean,
she had a freaking baby. Yeah. She has a lot to whine about. Yeah.
But she had feelings. She had feelings. Yeah. She spoke up, though. Mm-hmm. She loved her friends. She she was wrong a lot, and maybe we could see that as we're watching it. But I also felt like Hope was often the steady boat in rocky seas. Like I felt like they all, like I said, they were mom and dad. They didn't want, you know, anytime Hope and Michael were arguing and the other friends knew it, they were like the kids, like, no, no, what's going on here? Nope, mom and dad don't fight. Yeah. Like, right? And I related to being that steady boat in rocky seas a lot. And I also loved that everyone loved Hope. Like, I loved that that they knew they could count on her and rely on her.
She was their anchor. Yeah.
Yeah. And I loved, I had a whole bunch of, Melissa had a whole bunch of qualities that I just thought were so fun and so funny, too. So yeah. I also always loved Melissa, but Hope was my
And yet they're totally person. They're totally flawed, like you said, which is which makes them all the more relatable. And one of the episodes that makes me love Hope all the more was when her mother comes to visit and Hope can't not be a bitch to her mom. Mm-mm. And you're set up to think that Hope's mom is a bitch. But then you watch them together and you're like, Hope, I think it's you, honey. And even Michael is like, Hope, can you just back off a little bit? Like, let the woman breathe. And then you realize that Hope needs to go to therapy. And then, and by the end of the episode, Hope is like, yeah, I get it. I need to back off a little bit.
And that episode sorry, go ahead.
No, I just want to say, because I feel like I have to defend my comment from before, because I said that Hope was a little whiny. And I will say, when I was watching that show when I was in my 20s, I didn't want to be whiny. Like, that was realistic. Mm-hmm. And so to your point, like, yes, she was playing that role so well, and that's real life. But I was not going to be the whiner. I was going to be, you know, glass half full. We've got this. So when I said those qualities were not some that I wanted to, those were ones I didn't want to have that Hope had. But
see,
those
were
real.
It all comes back to us. It all comes back
really
to ourselves.
Doesn't it?
It's so
and our personalities. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Because that episode with Hope's parents, which is very early in season one.
Yeah.
I remember so vividly at age 18 – projecting myself and seeing that's how I will be with my mother. And when we were just watching it a couple weeks ago, Brian looked over at me halfway through and he's like, yeah, I don't see you as Hope at all. Ha, like, ha, ha, ha. Like, you were, that was 100% you with your mother.
Wow. When,
but see, I see it from Hope's point of view too. And I can be like, instead of, because Brian kept going, don't you see how she's like kind of being bratty and bitchy? And I was going, no, her mother, look what, you know, and I'm defending Hope. Uh-huh. But also because it was so interesting seeing Hope not as the mother or the wife, how we had seen her for the first few episodes, but seeing her as the daughter. And then you got a glimpse back into her childhood, which, you know, played into a lot how she was then responding to her mother all of a sudden being like, I'm the perfect mother now.
It's so, so personal. Yeah, and I think it's worth mentioning, too, that I absolutely 100% ended up with Hope's life, I mean, including her frustrations. I mean, carbon copy her frustrations. Everything that Hope struggled with, I struggled with. And I'm like, how did I get here? And I got there the same way that Hope did. Because it's kind of a trap a little bit. You know, and I don't need to go into that too deeply, but it is, you know.
Well, for our generation especially. Yeah. I mean, you're sold two bill of goods and they didn't
mesh. Yes.
Which was the very end of that first of the pilot episode when Hope and Ellen are at the park. And they admit both, each of them are a little jealous about, you have something that I want. When they each thought that the other thought that they didn't want any,
that they were
had nothing in common.
Other.
Yeah. And they're, rejecting the lifestyles that they had both chosen when in reality, they both wanted a little something that the other had.
Hope wanted her freedom and Ellen wanted her domesticity.
Yeah.
And
we wanted both. I mean, let's just say back then. Or, you know, as we got our jobs and got married and had kids, you kind of wanted both because you had been told both were great, but both didn't work together at the same time.
Really. How can you do both?
No, but but they do a great job. I mean, I was surprised looking back on it that it was as early as it was in season one that Hope goes back to work. I thought it was in like season two or three. But then they do a really good job of showing that struggle and the guilt she feels of not being with Janie.
Yeah,
and then she wants to have another baby. And I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Unlike the nighttime soaps of the 1980s, I think it's very clear that we could insert ourselves into the lives of these characters instead of just being observers into the lives of like oil tycoons and winery matriarchs and things like that. The problems may not have been about mergers and takeovers and love triangles, but that does not mean that the problems were small or uninteresting. The inverse is actually true. We were spellbound by them because they could actually happen to us.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about, like, I mean, we've been talking a lot about Nancy's ovarian cancer scare, but just the whole way it started where she's, I just remember that first episode and she was like at the doctor and she was like, I've just got this little pain. You know, they're, Edswick and Marshall Herskovitz are taking just these normal, really real life things, or it could be Michael and Elliot, you know, when they worked at the Michael and Elliot company and they're arguing over, you know, Michael's feeling like Elliot's liked more by one of their clients than he is or whatever. So yeah, they're not having to take these dynasty Dallas level type issues and problems that are so unrelatable to all of us. They're taking someone going to the doctor with a pain, and now all of a sudden it turns into cancer. They're taking a work relationship where there's a little bit of jealousy involved. They're taking Michael and Hope getting into a fight because, my God, when is there going to not be drywall exposed in my kitchen?
Right.
You know, or the
or
leaky
are we doing
pipes
Christmas
or the
Hanukkah?
Whatever.
Like, which one
exactly.
are we doing?
Mm-hmm. And so they weren't. They weren't these otherworldly, like, they weren't like these big problems. They were real problems that were big.
Yeah.
They were real big problems.
Exactly.
Right. And so that's why I feel like they were way more important than,
to us,
you know, the problems that the Carringtons or the Ewings or, you know, were
facing.
Well,
and you said, Michelle, just a few minutes ago, that these were problems that Edswick and Marshall Herskovitz were experiencing themselves, or their friends were, or some of the other writers were. Like, these were real life experiences that sometimes they're bringing in stuff that had happened, like, in their lives. There's a how do I want to say this? They often would bring like a fight that they had the week before with their one of their wives, and that would make its way into the script. And interestingly enough, Edswick has a wonderful memoir out called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions that I've listened to on Audible because I love memoirs being read by the person that it's about, their memoir. And he tells those stories about these exact moments that they are basically replicating the week after, 2 weeks after. And interestingly enough, both Marshall and Ed's wives worked on the show as well, whether as writers or I think maybe director kind of pieces here and
there. I think they were like story editors or something.
Okay,
for some
So
they would each take over, like one of them would be in charge of writing or editing Nancy and Elliot. One of them was in charge of someone else's storyline. They had different writers, and their wives, weirdly, were in charge because the total difference of Hope and Michael and Elliot and Nancy. And I think those two marriages kind of reflect Marshall's marriage and Ed's marriage. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's how real life it was. And when you listen to this, to him talk through this whole experience of 30-something, it is so reflective of their exactly what's happening in their lives, or even in the cast members' lives. Mm-hmm. Like, they would share because they were so close and so friendly. And so you'd maybe come in and talk about, I mean, Mel Harris might come in and talk about her divorce. I think it was her third divorce she was going through while the show was on. And she might come in and, you know, talk about something that had happened. And like they said, I mean, a few weeks later, you read something similar in one of the scripts. So that's why it was real.
You have to be careful what you would walk in and share, probably, right?
Yes, well, that's what he says in the book, that eventually people started to be a little bit more close-mouthed or close-lipped on their lives because they saw it weaving itself into the storylines. But getting back to what we were saying, because it's real life and we are not having to imagine, you know, living on a big ranch in Dallas. It could be our friends or us or the people across the street.
And so we're paying attention.
And this was the first time, as Ed even talks about in his memoir, the first time there was ever really a show like this where it wasn't some aspirational family that seemed perfect. It was real life and very character driven. This stuff was really could really happen to real people. Anytime.
Yeah, like the anti-Donna Reed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And so anyway, how do I say this? while listening to that memoir, I was struck by how much Ed Zwick has influenced, particularly my life when it comes to entertainment, TV or movies. And I just want to share a quick list of some of the programming and entertainment he was responsible for, because I could track my Gen X life a little bit through his, through his career. So when we're talking TV, we're talking Family. That was his first show. We're talking Christy McNichol Family, okay, 1976 to 1980. He came in and directed and wrote episodes for that. He's only in his 20s when this is happening.
How old it was he? Like,
right out of the gate.
Oh my gosh.
It was right out of the gate. And he, and I on Carolyn's advice, Brian and I started listening to Ed Zwick's memoir. It's highly recommended, you guys. It's so great. We're only a couple hours into it, but yes, right out of the gate. And like you said, didn't he kind of save Family too? Like, didn't he kind of come in and he was responsible? He started low, but then like the writer quit or something. And they're like, almost like, boy, you step in, step up, you're up to bat. And he was like, okay.
Yeah. And when you think
about
it.
And also think about it, that's also very real.
Yeah.
Family.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Yes, of course. No, exactly. You know, you really think that might have been what kind of paved the way. Both ABC shows, by the way, Battle of the Network Stars ABC.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Those all got the green light from ABC. Then he went on after 30-something to do My So-Called Life, which I know some of our younger than us Gen Xers maybe, that was, that's a cult classic for a lot of people.
And that's doing the same thing with 30-something with a younger age group.
Exactly.
With high schoolers.
Exactly.
The same thing. What are these everyday problems that they have?
And then he went on to do Once and Again.
Oh,
which,
I love that show.
I know.
So
okay. It's, you know, sometimes you don't know that what you don't
Ward.
Know.
Oh,
yes. And then he did a bunch of movies, but probably the movie that put him on the map in terms of film credit, and it's probably my Gen X, what do I want to say? Just my Bible movie. I wanted this life before I had Hope and Michael's life. This is the life I wanted. In 1986, I wanted to be Demi Moore in About Last Night. That
was About Last
goals.
Night.
He is About Last
oh
Night.
Oh my God.
Can you believe it? And so I just, he has a stamp on so many shows that defined a particular time in my growing up. There was Family, then there was About Last Night, and then there was 30-something, and then there was Once and Again. He also did Glory, which is a great section of that book when he talks about that
so
movie and how it got made, and it's pretty powerful. And it wasn't just him. He shares in the book that a lot of the actors, as well as other directors during 30-something and some of the other writers, went on to do some pretty amazing things, like the birth of some particular TV shows and other things happened because of 30-something. We know that Ken Olin goes on to become a showrunner and a director. Timothy Busfield, the great Peter Horton / Gary. Thank God he didn't die in real life, because there's so many great
shows. And that's why
he
had to die on the show, is because he had to go on and direct.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just listen to this, okay? The richness of their resumes since 30-something ended. And it's really hard to imagine television without some of these shows that I'm going to tell you right now. So besides Ken and Timothy and Peter Horton, our Patricia, Melanie, a lot of them have gone on to do other things that were not necessarily acting. Okay.
Yeah,
and some
of the
other writers on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So they've gone on to be producers, directors, executive producers, showrunners. Here's a list of the shows. Alias, My So-Called Life, Friday Night Lights, Brothers and Sisters, Grey's Anatomy, Parenthood, New Amsterdam, Breaking Bad, Without a Trace, Nashville, Once and Again, Damages, Jane the Virgin, In Treatment, and This Is Us.
Unbelievable.
And
you know, I just watched a movie with Polly Draper that just came out with right now Polly Draper, who is Ellen. She plays Ellen. It's called Shiva Baby, and I loved it. It's a super annoying movie, but super quirky, and she is the star of that movie. She is so good.
We'll have to put
Shiva
that in
Baby.
Yeah, they
Shiva
all,
Baby, yeah.
And many of them also directed episodes of 30-something.
Right.
At least once. I know, like, you know, Peter Horton, Ken Olin, Timothy Busfield,
Patricia Wedding handful. Too, right?
Yeah,
a good handful. Mm-hmm. And like even Mel Harris directed one. Mm-hmm. So they all tried their hand at it, and they all, you know, also let's not forget Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz were 30 something as well. They're the same age as the actors.
Yeah.
So they all had this kind of very, this relationship that wasn't like I'm the director and you guys are the actors. They all were kind of on the level. And so Ed Zwick, they didn't direct every episode. Certainly they had lots of other people come in and direct as well. But then they were very open to saying to the actors, sure, give it a try. We got such great television from it.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, for a show that was only on for 4 years, it had a tremendous amount of awards. 30 something was nominated for a total of 91 awards.
Oh my God.
63 nominations for the Primetime Emmy Awards, 28 nominations for the Golden Globes. It ultimately won 28 awards out of those nominations, 13 Emmys and two Golden Globes. Now, there was a whole host of other organizations like the Directors Guild of America, the Television Critics, blah, blah, blah. Most of the awards were won in the first two seasons or the first three seasons. However, that second look episode just kind of cleaned up too.
Yeah.
Some acting awards of note. The entire series won Outstanding Drama Series in 1988. So that would have been for season one.
Wow. Okay.
Timothy Busfield won in 1991 for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Drama. Patricia Wedig won three 88 in 1988, 1990, and 1991 for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama. These are Emmys. And so I'm like 88, 90, and 91. Then who won in 89? And that would have been Dana Delaney for China Beach. So you kind of see who she's up against there. Melanie Mayrin won an Emmy in 1989 for Best Supporting Actress. The show won Outstanding Writing in 1988. Patricia Wedig won the Golden Globe in 1990 for Best Actress in a TV Drama, and the show won the Golden Globe for Best Drama Series in 1989. So it was kind of cleaning up.
That is impressive. Yeah.
30-something also placed in the number 19 spot on TV Guide's 50 Greatest Shows of All Time in 2002. And in 2013, TV Guide placed it as number 10 in its list of the 60 greatest dramas of all time.
Wow.
You guys, this is for a show that was on for 4 years.
Interestingly enough, when we were traveling not long ago, and I was at this bed and breakfast we were staying in, I was chatting with one of the other women that was staying there, and somehow the fact that I had a podcast came up and talking about what it was about. And so I shared with her that we were going to be doing an upcoming episode on 30-something, and she was like, dumbstruck. I mean, you would have thought I was one of the actors right there. She could not believe. Are you kidding me? Like, you would have thought I was Mel Harris at the way this woman reacted. And she just starts just, oh my gosh, that show was everything to me. And she proceeds to tell me that at one point in her life, I don't know how many years ago this would have been, but she just had a rough go after a week of works. Just things were not good. She was kind of at a low point. And she rented the entire series, all four seasons of 30-something. And she spent the whole weekend. This is before we could binge and all of that stuff, like, or stream. She watched every single one of those episodes to make her feel better. And we know it's not like you're going to laugh for all of that time. Mm-hmm. It was that comfort again that we've talked about so often, and that nostalgia. And she said, those are my friends. And you know, those were your friends at a certain time. And so she said it took exactly 2 full days to watch the whole series all the way through. But it was the balm that she needed. It was one of those moments, I think, of like, you too? Like, she just felt seen. And
Okay, I have a couple of fun facts that I wanted to share with you. Did you guys know that the word 30-something was added to the Oxford English Dictionary as a direct result of its popular usage from this series? Isn't that fun?
When I saw that, it triggered a memory that the word 30-something was new. Like, they had made up a word, and we're like, that's a cute word they made up. But would you, if somebody asked you on the street, like, when did the word 30-something come, you'd think, well, it always existed. But no, they
probably
made it up.
Probably. Okay, who do you guys think was the only actor to appear in all 85 episodes of the series?
Well, it's got to be Hope. Doesn't it have to be Hope?
Elliot.
Wrong. It's Ken Olin. he was Michael's in every episode. Michael's in every episode. Okay, I think this is really kind of a cool thing. There's a scene in the episode called Strangers, showing Russell and Peter in a post-coital conversation. Now, I'm not really, who Russell and Peter were exactly?
Yes. So Russell is a really good friend of Melissa's. Wait.
Okay. Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Melissa's really, played by David Marshall Grant. I think I can picture him. Yeah.
And he meets Peter, who is who works at the ad agency. So Melissa is coming in to do some photography work and meet Miles, and Russell comes with her, and then he is introduced to Peter, and they go on to have to get to know each other, go on some dates, and they have this scene in bed together, which is, at that time, the first scene like that in television.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Yeah, so you never really see them kiss or do anything. You just see them in bed in a post-coital conversation. And it's widely believed to be the first time gay male characters were ever shown in bed together in a sexual content on American network television. And just the fact that it was implied that they had sex was enough to prompt the loss of about $1.5 million worth of advertising revenue.
Oh my God.
Because a lot of the ad companies withdrew their commercials. So ABC pulled the episode out of rerun and syndication. And so the only time it was seen again was when the show was released on DVD.
Oh my God, so is it on? It is on the DVD, so you can access it now.
Yes, I watched it on YouTube. It's on YouTube as well.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
If you missed it then, you missed it for a while.
So Timothy Busfield, who, you know, listeners, longtime listeners know, he's a friend of ours. We like to call him Timmy. God, I got the biggest hug from Timothy Busfield in Chicago that time. And I don't know if you guys remember, it was like 2022. We had gone to see Melissa in this play, and she had asked, it was right after we had interviewed her on the podcast. So she's like, stick around after so I can say hi. And then she's like, oh, Timmy's in that car behind you. And we're like, what? I feel like the Omicron variant had just resurfaced. So everybody's wearing masks. Like Melissa Gilbert was like, I wish I could hug you, but I'm in this play and I have to wear this mask. And nope, Timothy Busfield gets out of the SUV, no mask, runs around the car, hugs me so hard, gives Brian, shakes his hand with that big bro hug, hugs my daughter, talk for a long time, gets back in. And we were all very, very aware of Purell and masks, and especially right then. We walked down the street, Brian, because, you know, like I told you, I had made him watch, not made him, he liked it, but, you know, the last three seasons of 30-something for sure. He's just holding his hand in front of him, and he's just like, if I get COVID from Elliot, that's like the coolest story I've ever had to tell in my life. And we get in the car and I'm like, you want Purell? And he's like, hell no. Like, I want to get COVID from Elliot. Well, Timmy was actually just 29 when he was cast in the pilot. He grew that beard so he would look old enough to play the part of 30-something.
Wow. And now I think about seeing him in things when he's younger, and you can see his unbearded face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
On TV shows.
He was in Family Ties. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was in Family Ties.
But has he ever not had a beard since?
I don't think so. I can't
picture him without one.
I can't either. Yeah. Yeah. So Michael Stedman, the character, not Ken Olin, Michael Stedman was ranked number 46 in TV Guide's list of the 50 greatest TV dads of all time.
Oh,
really?
Okay, that was, I think
I'm
that
a little
was,
bit like, huh, okay.
That was sexy time. I think for us as, you know, 20-year-old women, to see a beautiful man fathering in a tender way like that, it just makes your ovaries kind of hurt. And I think that spoke, even if you weren't making, you know, even if you weren't aiming for that kind of life, that was something that was really sexy to observe.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Michael and Hope are probably the number one reason I had, you know, my first daughter at age 26, because I was still like, okay, we got married. Now we're supposed to have a daughter.
That's right.
Yeah.
And her name
is
Janie.
I did like that name, but no.
So this whole week, this conversation has been like therapy for me. I'm digging into my psyche and the things I wanted when I was growing up. And like, we're talking about growing up for real, not growing up like I want to be a horse girl when I grow up. Like, who do I want to be? So it may not have resonated with people who weren't grappling with what they wanted when they grew up. like my husband. And that's okay. That's okay. But I can't emphasize enough how revisiting this show is like turning over a stone and revealing my brain at a moment in time, examining your hopes and dreams and fears when you're kind of on the verge of choosing a path toward one of them. And if this was you, if you were like me, I highly recommend finding these episodes on YouTube and rewatching. If it's not you, do not do this because it won't mean anything to you. It might look like a lot of people standing around complaining, which is why some people say it was the precursor to Seinfeld. And some people even say it's the precursor to Friends. But for the three of us in this room, our time is up for today, ladies, and you can pay the receptionist on your way out. But wait, there's more. In a final twist of fate that could only happen on the Pop Culture Preservation Society, we will book another session for next week where we will have a guest therapist. You guys, I can barely even say it out loud. Hope. It's Hope. I'm not even kidding. It's Hope. I'm Mel Harris, the actor who played Hope Stedman, is going to be our guest on our episode next week, giving us the inside scoop on this generational drama, which was not even our generation, but somehow spoke to our generation. Hope is going to be here next week.
You guys, 19-year-old Michelle is dead. Like, she is on the floor. I'm looking at her on the floor right now. Her ponytail's all askew. That's her scrunchie's in.
Her scrunchie.
Y'all, I don't know. This is the biggest to me. And I have to do this now because I cannot do this next week. So I'm doing it now.
Yes, do it now. Get it out.
This is my Sean Cassidy guest. This is the biggest guest.
Yes.
To
You've
me.
You've been saying this since the beginning of the podcast. 19-year-old
Michelle and 56-year-old Michelle. This is my biggest get yet. I am going to be so chill next week. But from now until then, I am losing my flipping mind. I am... You guys, what? The what? I mean, I just remember 2 years ago, I posted a picture on my Instagram of all my little 30-something, because she was talking about the reboot. And I posted a picture of, like, it's a picture of me and Brian next to pictures of Hope and Michael and then the cast. And I said something cute about how much that show meant to me. And I think I tagged her in it and she liked it. And I thought that was going to do me in. And now... I've been emailing Mel Harris for the past 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have that moment that I've talked about with both of you guys when I love watching you have your moment. And yeah, it came in handy that you had that nice little bulletin board photo so you could post it and she saw it. And
that was years ago. That had nothing to do with this. I don't think she knows I'm the same person.
Oh,
we're not going to bring up the bulletin board, by the way.
Maybe we'll keep that one to ourselves.
We keep that on the DL, guys.
But wouldn't it be funny for you to hold it up while she was on the screen?
Well, she's seen it
in real time.
No. We're not crossing that line next week.
Yeah.
That's why, everyone, I'm getting it out right now.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I promise y'all I'm going to be chill. I am. I'm going to be chill.
Yeah.
There might be a substance involved to get me that way. I live in Colorado.
Whatever it takes.
You guys are like, whatever it takes, Michelle, for you not to pull out the bulletin board. Well, anyway, this was the end of our episode. So we do appreciate you guys being excited with us.
Yes.
And I know a lot of you all listening out there loved the show like we did. And we love all of you. We do. But we have a big bunch of folks who take their support of our podcast to the next level over on Patreon, where they pledge a little bit of their allowance monthly to help us keep this podcast and social media society and all that we do afloat. And we'd like to thank them with goodies like exclusive extras. And we mail them some goodies and we have Zoom events sometimes. And the very least we can do is to thank a group of them by name right here every week. Today, we're giving a shout out to Mary Beth, Kim, Lisa, Donovan, MP, Mike, Sandy, Alice, Alisa, Miriam, Linda, and Diane.
In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast to Hope and Michael, Elliot and Nancy, Gary and Melissa and Ellen, all courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
Two happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers.
Cheers. The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.